Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are discussing the television series Twin Peaks. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast. We will spoil you. So if you have not seen all of Twin Peaks, please go back and watch all of it in its entirety. Then come back and join us. We'd love to have you, but we don't want to ruin anything for you.
And if you've been listening to this podcast or you're listening to it for the first time today and you decided, hey, I love this podcast, I want to support it some way, go to iTunes, write us a review. That is the best way. Another way is to go to our website at noship.net and write us some feedback. And we only have so much material to cover left, but we can still feature your feedback in whatever installments we do after this.
And we also have an Amazon link. If you go to the site, you'll see it. Just click on it. It'll take you to the Amazon homepage. From there, you can do your shopping like normal, and it won't cost you anything extra, but we get a little bit of a kickback to pay for the pie and coffee around these parts.
Seriously, we actually use it to help pay for the storage of these podcasts. They're free for you, but not free for us to produce. So that's the reason why we're asking you to go click on a link at our website when you do your shopping. It doesn't cost you extra, but it helps us out.
Yeah, I always try to make a little on whatever, whichever show we're doing at the time. I always try to make a little joke that references that show. With the, you know, that's what we use the money for, but it's not. We haven't actually received any money yet because, you know, we're waiting for it to build up to that point. But when it does,
we're inching there.
Yeah, we're inching there like a little worm. But whenever we do get to that point, it's going to pay for the fees that we pay every month to kind of hold everything in storage and to make all this content available. So we'd ultimately like to get to the point where the podcast pays for itself, but you know, we can dream.
It's what Twin Peaks is all about.
Yeah, it's about dreaming, but it's a start, and I figure it's a good, you know, pitch to people since it's not actually asking for money. They're going to shop on Amazon anyway because everybody does shop on Amazon. So I just figure, you know, if you're there, just go use our link. Maybe we'll get a couple of pennies here and there.
So before we get started, do you have a PSA?
For the remainder of the podcast, for your safety and ours, please stay on the bike.
What did you think of this episode?
I was expecting it to be worse than it was. My memory was making it a lot worse in my head. And when I watched it, I actually found myself enjoying it. I don't know if I'm just in a good mood today, but I was pretty I was pretty forgiving of the sillier aspects, of which there is quite a bit in this episode. And I always remember that this episode wasn't one of my favorites because it just had the Miss Twin Peaks pageant, which I just find to be absurd in the first place. But Em pointed some stuff out to me in the corners of the show, watching Donna and Shelley kind of just ham it up and smoke cigarettes and do that. And we'll talk more about it when we get to that part. But it made it worthwhile, and I laughed out loud a couple of times. So there was actually some humor here that some of it might have been unintentional, but but there was some good laugh out loud moments.
The pageant was ridiculous in a way and entertaining because of it, so it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, that's the best way you can put it. It's the most charitable spin that you can put on that.
Yeah. All right, so we are discussing Twin Peaks. This episode's called Miss Twin Peaks, and it's written by Barry Pullman and directed by Tim Hunter. This episode opens with Leo and Major Briggs chained at Wyndham Earl's hideout. Major Briggs is unconscious. Leo struggles for a key, only to find it does not unlock his shackles, but it does unlock Major Briggs. As Major Briggs is slowly coming to, Leo says, "Save Shelley."
Yep, there's just two pals hanging out at the humble abode of Wyndham Earl.
So, I mean,
the significance of the key unlocking Garland's locks, yeah, but not his own.
Well, I wasn't going to ask. Like, there's just a lot about keys this episode.
Yeah, yeah, there is a key theme going on here. I don't know. I'm torn between thinking it's a plot device to get Major Briggs back to the sheriff's department, or is it a test for Leo to see if he would, you know, if he's going to be really, you know, Wyndham Earl's pal, or is he going to try to thwart him when he gets a chance?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, but it's also for us to see that Leo is really vying for Shelley's life here.
That could be it, too. You know, that could be actually more than the other two options that I offered.
But Major Briggs was in no condition to be concerned about Shelley because he doesn't bring her back up later.
Yeah, I seriously doubt if in his condition, shot up full of haloperidol, that he's going to remember anything at all.
Yeah. Later, Wyndham Earl returns looking deathly pale with red-rimmed eyes and blackened teeth. He notices Major Briggs is gone and realizes that Leo aided in his flight. He is not too overly concerned about this, and he tells Leo that he has a new game for him. This is where we really get a good look at the blackened choppers.
What is up with that? Why does he have the pale white powder face and the blackened teeth?
Well, we see Leland like that in Fire Walk With Me, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
So I don't, and didn't we see Laura like that also in Fire Walk With Me when she visits Harold?
Yes.
That's as far as I can take it. I don't really know. I mean, we can speculate. It has something to do with entering or the getting close to being where you're able to enter.
I would buy that, but he's closer to that later in the episode, I would think. So he kind
But
of shows
he
up.
just got back. He found, because he figured out last episode the
Oh,
map.
okay, all right.
So he went to the location. So he came close, and Laura was coming close in a different manner, because of her life experiences and choices and interactions with Bob. And then Leland actually entered, I think because of Garmon Bozia, right? Being possessed by Bob.
Yeah. But I'm trying to think if that's a physical manifestation of you being close to the lodge. After Cooper gets out of the lodge at the end of the next episode, he doesn't exhibit those traits.
I don't know. See, I'm like I said, I'm just
Yeah.
speculating.
I know. I'm just trying to kind of like
Well, what do you
play
think
with
it
it.
is then?
I don't know. I mean, that sounds like the closest thing to it is what you're saying about, just somehow the approximation to the Black Lodge is making you look that way and everything. I just thought it was I thought it was a really cool effect and it was pretty fucking creepy, but I thought it was a little bit weird that we see him there at the beginning of the episode like that, but then the very next scene you see him in, he looks normal again, and then he looks normal for the rest of the episode. Or like Margaret,
Well, I guess
whichever.
it probably doesn't take very much time for the effects to wear off, so maybe that's why we don't see it with Cooper. I mean, I don't remember how much time passes before we see him in the bathroom or in his room at the Great Northern next time. I don't know. We'll see. We'll be able to examine that a little bit closer when we get to the next episode.
Yeah, we'll revisit this conversation next week for sure.
So next at the Double R, Norma, Shelley, and Annie prepare for the festivities that will be surrounding Miss Twin Peaks. Norma is contributing pies, and she talks of how she thinks this event will help heal the town's wounds, the wounds that have resulted from Laura Palmer's murder, which it was weird that they brought up with them saying Laura Palmer. It was like, oh wait, it sounded weird.
It did. It shocks you almost back into, because didn't Annie say it? She was like, oh, you mean with
It
Laura
was
Palmer's
Annie, I
murder
know.
and everything. And it shocks you back into this mind frame of like, oh yeah, that's the whole reason any of this is happening in the first place.
And we learn here that Norma will be one of the judges and that she herself won the pageant 20 years ago. I wonder if she was the one that had the cherry pie recipe that Ben Horn is derisive about later.
The old animosities.
What does he have any animosity against her for?
I don't know, but he didn't seem to be very favorable of people spouting off cherry pie recipes. He wanted them to talk about, really hardcore. He wanted like an Earth First speech. He didn't want a cherry pie recipe.
The next scene opens with a shot of Audrey's bare feet as she sits by the fire, feeling bereft after Wheeler's recent departure. Ben enters with a collection of various religious texts from all over the world stacked in his arms. He is intent to read them all and find the answer that he is seeking. And then he notices her sadness and tells her that time heals all wounds, and this is apparently something he culled from all these books, so it's kind of a mixed message. Is he gonna read them and get his answer, or but he has already read them and he's already culled some wisdom out of it? I don't know. It's what
It's a confusing scene, but I think what he's saying is he comes in with a stack of books and he's like, I am going to glean whatever wisdom I can from all these books. I'm going to become a good person by reading them. I'm going to find all of the answers that everybody's looking for. And then he tells her that time heals all wounds, and that's one of the truths that, these books deliver. But I think that's kind of like a universal truism. He already knew that, and he knew in a roundabout way that they came from that kind of stuff, but he's never really put together the end result and the source before.
They talk about her short but concentrated time with the departed Wheeler. Now time of sentiment is over. Audrey stands up to tell her father the real reason she's in his office, and it is to update him about what the Packards are up to regarding the Ghostwood development. They are using savings and loans to funnel cash into the project, and the bank wants to keep all this under wraps. Ben says that they will make sure the opposite happens. Ben then turns the subject over to Miss Twin Peaks. Audrey is reticent about the idea and suggests that surely there must be a better way. He encourages her towards the pageant despite her protests.
I kind of agree with her. I think she's thinking more on a higher level than he is. He's stuck in this whole thing. Like I really don't see, as shrewd of a businessman as Ben Horn has always been, it seems weird that he would fixate on what she could possibly say to a crowd of onlookers at the Twin Peaks pageant that would sway stuff in his favor as far as the Ghostwood Project is concerned.
For as successful as he is, he really thinks small time.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. He's thinking very, very small. I mean, this is a podunk town in the big giant expanse of the Pacific Northwest, and what does it matter who wins this pageant and what they have to say about it? I mean, the winner of it 20 years ago is running a freaking diner, you
And
know?
you could equate it with Loretta from Justified, though, like working the community politics in order to get a foothold on some local business.
Yeah, I guess that's the most charitable way to look at it, is that he's trying to use her to work the community to get it in his favor. Because, I mean, it's not going to be a vote on the Senate floor in the state. It's going to be a localized thing. So I guess there is something to it. But it just still seems out of place for his character to be thinking so, you know, small letter rather than capital letter about this issue.
So now at the sheriff's department, Andy stands before the petroglyph, lost in thought. Meanwhile, Harry and Cooper talk about Wyndham and what he may want with Major Briggs. Cooper reveals some of the circumstances surrounding Josie's death that he has been holding back due to Harry's hurt feelings. He tells Harry that Josie displayed a great fear, which seemed to have attracted Bob. He believes that Bob is from the Black Lodge and that the Black Lodge is the source of what Harry calls the evil in the woods. Cooper is concerned that Wyndham is seeking his way into the Black Lodge because of its source of great power. Cooper would prefer to beat Wyndham there first, and then what?
Yeah, what's going to happen when you get there?
I know.
Not very well thought out on that front. I mean, nobody knows what awaits them in the Black Lodge, so I don't know. It seems like you're just racing headlong into a question mark.
Think he put crime scene tape up at the entrance? Do not enter.
It's posted. Do not
Yes.
enter.
Wyndham has been listening to this conversation between Cooper and Harry via the bonsai tree. From this, he learns that fear is the key to open the Black Lodge. So there's another key. And he becomes very excited about this fact. I should point out that Wyndham has regained his normal color and his teeth are no longer black, which you've already brought up. He prepares to take his queen, and before he leaves, he gives Leo some departing words. Leo is holding a cage of spiders above his head by his teeth.
Yeah, and this is the last shot we ever get of Leo, because I don't think they go back to him in the next episode because they're too caught up with, if I'm cor I think I'm correct on that. We'll see.
I believe so, but I'm not sure.
Because there's a lot of threads that just kind of get completely cut off, because next episode mostly deals with the Black Lodge and Cooper trying to find Annie. So, and then there's the bank stuff as well. But
And Donna, I think, too. There's more with Donna and Ben.
so if they even bring Eric DeRay back for the 2016 run of Twin Peaks, I mean,
Which I
there's gonna
hope they do.
I hope they bring as many people back as they possibly can. Like, whoever will sign up for it, David Lynch should try to find a way to work them into the story. Just out of, not just out of a sense of nostalgia, because you don't want it to be there for the sake of being there. But I mean, everybody who was involved with Twin Peaks helped to make it what it was, I think. So if they want to be part of it, they should be allowed to be part of it, and there should be a part written for them, I think. But if he does come back, I mean, what? It's just going to be it, that's just part of the excitement that I got for this whole thing, because how are they going to explain how these loose ends all, you know, because they're not going to go right back to it. It's not going to be a day after thing. The 25 years has actually elapsed in Twin Peaks, right? That's how it's going to be approached. So anyway, I'm running out of ways to say interesting and exciting and cool, so I'm just going to go on to the next subject. But I'm eager to see what's going to happen with him, because how long can you hold a string in your frickin' mouth? You're gonna give up. You're gonna fall asleep. Your muscles are gonna slacken, and all those
Yeah,
spiders are gonna,
before anything else.
they're gonna bust loose on your head, and I guess bite you and kill you.
Depends what kind of spiders they are, but I'm pretty sure he could suffer some bites maybe with those, and
Well, yeah, it's not like if
I
they're
mean
not poisonous, they're not gonna kill him.
I think they're tarantulas.
Well, that'd just be like creepy if you had arachnophobia, but other than that, it would just be an annoyance.
Yeah. Next scene, Mr. Pinkle is putting the contestants through dance choreography. It is like herding cats. Donna and Shelley are not taking it seriously.
This is what we were talking about when they're hamming it up.
Smoking a cigarette.
Shelley has these just like totally unflattering sweatpants on, but she's doing like this really goofy dance over in the corner. It's almost like they're they're having fun. I feel like that was almost unscripted, and they're having fun at the expense of it and going, look, this is just ridiculous, so we're just going to have fun over here and do what we want to do.
Yeah, but it's almost like they're not taking their job seriously as a whole, as actors within Twin Peaks, because it does seem like they're out of character a little
Yeah, they are, 'cause I mean
bit.
all of the stuff that's pressing down on everybody has their personal concerns that are kind of coming to a head and everything, and nobody's exempt from that in the whole cast, but they're just finding time to just kind of goof off and do whatever.
Meanwhile, Norma, Mayor Milford, and Dick discuss judge business. A man carries a deer statue rather suggestively in the foreground.
That scene's just weird. I don't really know what to make of that. This guy looks like he's banging this little deer from behind as he's walking by everybody. I'm kind of like, what the fuck? That was the first laugh out loud moment. I mean, there's a certain amount of that patented Twin Peaks absurdity that goes with it, but this was almost just like too in your face. It didn't bother me. I'm not upset with it. It's just really weird.
After the judge meeting breaks up, Lana asks Dick if he can help her look for something in the storage closet so she can find something in his pants.
There's some sex in this episode. There's a couple of pairings going on, and we don't know the extent of which, went on in this closet, but I mean, Boy George.
He got a handy, at least.
Or what, did he say Boy George, or did he say By
By
George?
George.
Huh.
I think it was by George.
By George. Jeez. I mean,
And then later on, doesn't Cooper say by heavens
something like
or oh
that,
my
yeah.
heavens?
Yeah.
Anyway, in his room at the Great Northern, Cooper talks to Diane. He has just finished meditating and he is mulling over the Black Lodge and his feelings for Annie when there is a knock at the door. Speaking of Annie, she is in the midst of a panic about writing her speech. Cooper offers aid, which leads to personal talk, which then leads to kissing and then to sex.
This whole scene is awkward for me because, first of all, when Annie comes in, she's delivering more of that stiff acting that we've criticized her so much before about. And she says, I'm having a, what did she say, sweaty palm, full panic, or something to that effect. And as an actress, she's really not conveying to the viewer that she's panicky at all.
No.
She seems actually like, it's almost like somebody gave her like a Xanax, and she's just kind of delivering her lines before she goes over into the corner to go to sleep. You know, and then her and Cooper share this intimate moment, and then they go to have sex, and it goes away for me to a ways down the road of like, you know how you felt when Cooper was in flannel? That's how I feel when Cooper is
With Annie.
with Annie and he's getting sexual. It's like I don't want to see that side of him. I want to see him as the upright, sharp guy in the suit and the tie and the trench coat who's drinking coffee and just that kind of Cooper, and it shatters that vision of him for me, and I feel like it's out of character. Just like you feel like the flannel's out of character, I feel like this scene was out of character.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can't add more to that.
I think as much as the scene didn't sit well with me for all the reasons I just described, I do see why it's necessary because you have to kind of form that link between the two of them and take it a step further so he'll be willing to do what he does to go find her in the next episode.
Well, the woman always has to have sex or lose her virginity before she gets killed.
That's a good point too. So we're getting a little tropey with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the buzzword around this house lately is tropey. You're being a tropey wife. Doo-doo-tsh.
Okay, now at the Hurleys, Nadine is preparing her presentation, which is, I'm assuming, what this is all about, for the pageant before Mike, Dr. Jacoby, Ed, and Norma. Dr. Jacoby changes the subject of conversation to the more serious life event of breaking up. Nadine says she is happy, but she is worried that Ed will be sad. Ed tells Nadine that he and Norma are getting married. Cracks begin to show here with Nadine as she crushes Mike's hand into pieces.
See, I think this is par for the course with Nadine, though, because she's always wanted to do, in this teenage character that she is now, she's always wanted to do what she's wanted to do with Mike, but she's always wanted Ed to be jealous of it. And whenever he's not, then I don't think it, not to contradict what you're saying, but I don't see it as cracks forming. I see it more like just keeping in line with how she was, because I think the transformation is when she gets banged in the head with the sandbag and then brings her back to her real self. I don't think she was tending towards that beforehand. I could be wrong though.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it could be just a foreshadowing event, or
True,
she's
yeah.
trending towards that. Major Briggs struggles through the woods. Hawks discovers him on the road. Major Briggs says, "Which way to my castle?"
What in the hell is he talking about? Which way to his castle?
Well, he did get shot a pool of haloperidol, but more on that later.
Yeah. Well,
And you pointed out, of course, it would be Hawk that finds him.
yes. Yep. It's I've said this before, but ever since Daniel brought it up ages ago about how Hawk is the only one really doing the police work, although Andy gets a little bit of credit in this episode, he's actually doing some police work as well. But he's the one who finds him. He's the one. What is Harry doing? Hawk finds him doing the real job of the TPPD, and
Toilet paper police department.
exactly, exactly.
So now at the sheriff's department, Major Briggs is sitting hunched over under a blanket. Cooper sniffs him and determines that he's been shot up with haloperidol. I did a little research and I read us some message boards discussing why would Wyndham Earl use haloperidol when it's not an effective truth serum.
What did you come up with?
Well, nobody really knows. There was just a lot of debate whether it smells. A lot of people just reporting the symptoms without coming up with an answer. So I just think maybe it was a way for him to cover his tracks, as we can see here, because he's unintelligible.
Okay, so what you're saying is it wasn't his intent necessarily for Leo to let him go, but he knew that it was a distinct possibility after all, leaving that key around. So if it did happen, he'd be shot up with this drug and he couldn't be of any use to anybody. Either.
I'm just trying to, it's just like, why was he pale and had black teeth? I'm just trying to like throw ideas as to why. It doesn't mean it's
I agree,
valid.
though. I agree. I think that makes the most sense. He is playing the long game, and whatever eventuality took place, nobody was able to, nobody was going to be able to get information out of Garland Briggs at that point, or Judy Garland.
I thought he did a good job acting.
Yeah, he did. He seemed loopy for sure.
It made me almost uncomfortable. Like I almost felt it.
I felt it a little bit when he was at the sheriff's station and he's shaking and he's drinking the water and he's, because I suffer from anxiety sometimes and you feel like you want to start shaking like that sometimes, like your body's about to, and that was a good, physical representation of what it feels like sometimes. But I don't know, I stopped taking my prescription of haloperidol years ago, so I don't remember exactly how. All right, on to the next scene.
Yeah, on to the next scene. So Andy comes into the room to observe the petroglyph once more. It is like he's drawn to it. Cooper is talking about the Black Lodge existing at a particular point of space and time when Andy interrupts to ask Harry if the petroglyph could have anything to do with the 4-H Club. Harry says it is unlikely. I'm thinking Andy should probably field those questions to Cooper anyway.
Yeah, he should be addressing Cooper and Cooper alone because Harry's still grieving from Josie at this point, and he's never been the sharpest knife in the drawer to begin with, and he's way out of his league and over his head, whatever other cliches you want to add on to that with this whole scenario. If Cooper wasn't in town and Wyndham Earl was in town for some reason, Wyndham Earl would be mayor at this point because it would be that level of ineptcy going on.
Wyndham Earl would be mayor.
Yeah, because he wouldn't be able to do anything to stop him. So I'm just, I know it's a way out there scenario, but I'm just commenting on the quality of the police work that's on offering here.
Andrew Packard and Pete tried to open the metal box with a cramjack heavy duty vise.
I've seen one of those vices before. Those things are pretty cool.
Is it cramjack? Is that
I don't know
an actual name?
I don't know if that's a brand name. I've just always heard them called a vice. Maybe that is the 'cause there's different kinds of vices 'cause you have handheld ones as well.
Yeah,
Or
there's a ton of different kinds.
maybe that's the type that you like that is attached to the table. But I've used one of those before. It's pretty cool.
So they didn't have any success with the vise. Andrew, in frustration, shoots the box with success. Inside rests a key. Catherine places the key inside a cake saver in plain view.
I thought the cake saver was interesting because when you first see the shot, it's you see Catherine at the table sipping her coffee, and the cake saver's completely empty. And you're thinking, this is Twin Peaks. There's got to be some pie or some donuts or danishes somewhere around. And I want to say the last time we saw that cake saver, it actually had some of those pastries inside of it. And now there's none, so it's just a, like there's going to be something in there because it's front and center in the scene. But the only thing that I really have to say about the scene is that it's incredibly loud and dangerous to shoot a high caliber revolver like that inside of a house at a metal box at short range. It's not your hearing, just your
It
hearing.
could ricochet.
Well, look at the shredded, ruin of metal that the box was. That
Yeah.
shrapnel could have flew into Pete's eye, I mean, and that's the only character I'm worried about in that room. The other two could have got shrapnel anywhere, and I really wouldn't care. But, you know, I don't want anything to happen to Pete.
Catherine would have walked around with an eye patch, just like Nadine after.
That'd be a bad look for her.
So Donna is dressed for the pageant, and before leaving the house, she decides now is the time to confront her whore mother about Benjamin Horn. Neither Mrs. Hayward or Doc Hayward are able to bring themselves to spill the beans. Donna leaves, saying she will ask Ben herself.
This scene was kind of weird because she basically says, you guys taught me to tell the truth. You raised me that way. Now I'm asking you to reciprocate. Tell me the truth about Ben Horn. And they're like, well, no, we don't need to do this right now. That isn't the time and place, blah, blah, blah. And then she says, well, if you don't do it, I'm going to ask him directly. And they still don't do it. So it's like, why wouldn't they jump at the chance to give their version of events first rather than let her go to Ben Horn and have him say whatever the fuck is going on in his head at the time?
Maybe there's an explanation next episode. I don't remember. But Donna is able to compartmentalize her life really well because anytime she's in the pageant, she's having a grand old time. More on that later.
It's like these scenes were culled together from two different episodes or something like that. You know, we had serious Donna, and then you have the, I'm going to smoke a cigarette in the corner, Donna.
Back at the sheriff's department, Cooper discovers the Jupiter and Saturn conjunction as illustrated in this petroglyph. Major Briggs suddenly says, protect the queen, and fear and love opens the door. These verbal clues help Cooper determine that everything hinges on the Twin Peaks pageant. Cooper and Harry leave hurriedly. Andy, who's still looking at the petroglyph and now is trying to get their attention, knocks over the bonsai tree, which unearths Wyndham's planted bug.
So that it's kind of, Andy acts as the fool in this episode because he does something that he didn't intend to and it reveals something important. That is a fool's action, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, but if he were to be able to reveal to them, if they would just fucking listen to him, he would have been able to tell them that it was a map, which none of the other combined minds of police work in this town were able to do. But Wyndham Earl was able to do it. So I guess Andy's revealing himself to be somewhat of a savant here in a certain way.
Yeah, but I mean, more importantly, Harry and Cooper are just being complete jerks to him.
Yeah, that's true. They just feel like he's not going to have anything good to add to any conversation. He's just going to say something stupid like, oh, the 4-H Club. But there was actually a reason why he said 4-H Club. You know, and I've always liked Andy, so I don't like it when people treat him that way. You know, I don't like it when Mr. Rosenflower talks smart to him.
Yeah, because after a while, you know, he might start taking it personally and not be as helpful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you do that to people, they react to it after a while. And it's like, well, if my contribution isn't wanted, I'm just going to shut up. And then maybe you would have said something super useful at some point that could have saved someone's life.
Yeah, they could have got there first if they just listened to Andy. They could have maybe started heading towards there instead of going to the pageant to head off Wyndham Earl. But I don't know.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. Because it was a stupid thing to think that you could stop Wyndham Earl from doing whatever he's doing. Because all this time, Cooper has done nothing but praise his deviousness and how much of a genius he is and how much he's able to do these things that nobody else can. So if he has a plan to steal somebody or to kidnap somebody from the Twin Peaks pageant, he's going to follow through on that and he's going to do it. So you might as well just bypass that altogether, let it happen, and just surprise him.
Be devious yourself.
Yeah, exactly. You know, try to outfox the fox instead of just go, well, I'm going to stand here and watch it happen and then just kind of scratch my head as what to do next.
So the Twin Peaks pageant is on and it is off to a fairly chaotic start. The dance looked like it was on the verge of falling to pieces at any moment. Mr. Pinkle attempts to snuggle with a log lady. Lucy commences the talent competition with a series of pirouettes. Bobby's watching the pageant from backstage, noticing the log lady and Mr. Pinkle. After this, he discovers another log lady, which we know is Wyndham Earl in disguise. Bobby gets thwacked in the head by the log.
He's like, who did you bring your whole family here? So stupid.
It's a funny line, though.
Hey, you know, Bobby getting smacked with that, it's like it took Wyndham Earl, dressed as Margaret, the frickin' log lady, to give Bobby the smack in the head or the mouth or whatever, the what for that everybody's wanted him to get at several different times during the whole series.
Cooper and Harry arrive at the end of Lucy's performance. Lana is up next and her dance is entrancing to the men, so we are led to believe. Audrey gives her speech. Donna confronts Ben about he and her mother. Her hair is weird. Do pine weasels make nests? She should check her hair. Anyway, Ben confirms what she has been fearing, that he is her father, and she runs off.
So,
but the next time we see her, she and Shelley and Audrey are jumping for joy on stage after Annie wins.
She's either a really good compartmentalizer or a really good emotional digester. She has like a really good, you know, like her emotional metabolism is just cranking it out. You know, in comes the negative, out comes the positive, out the other end, and she's good to go. I just had a couple of things in my notes for the show. Lucy is pregnant, right?
Why didn't I even think of that?
Because this chick isn't just doing if I'm not mistaken, she's got a garter belt on that has like a dollar bill poking through it.
I don't know, but she's also running and jumping and landing in splits.
Exactly. That cannot be good for the baby.
But it is daddy day.
Yeah, true, true. And then the, what's her name? The Milford's wife.
Lana.
The actress has been reminding me of somebody the whole time that we've seen her this view, and I couldn't put my finger on it, and then I was finally able to say who she reminds me of because she just had her face outlined and I didn't see her hair, and she looks like she could be the older sister or mother to the actresses Kate and Rooney Mara.
Really?
She looks like Kate Mara, kind of.
Huh.
From she was, you know.
I know who she
yeah,
is.
Yeah, okay, yeah. For people who out there listening who don't know, the first season of American Horror Story and House of Cards and probably a bunch of other stuff. But that's what I've seen her in. But anyway, yeah, the dance was just kind of, this whole thing is absurd. So
Donna, I already said that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. And what I had about Donna is when she finally confronts Benjamin Horn and he says that, you know, he doesn't even want to talk about it. You know, he's even kind of trying to take this tack. Like, this is something that we need to sit down with your parents and just kind of discuss.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't something you need to be cornering me backstage and asking me about. But she does find out that that's her dad. And luckily for her, she doesn't have to lose a hand for the information. She handles it a lot better than Luke. So she might have a pine weasel nesting in her hair, but she's not being whiny. So, you know, look at the positive side of everything.
Annie gives her speech, which is supposed to be more appealing than Lana's dance. Wyndham Earl, meanwhile, is positioning himself above the rafters, or whatever you want to call them. The lighting fixtures.
The light rigging.
Lucy reminds Annie and Dick that it is indeed Dad Day, and that she has chosen Andy. Dick is not upset by this, it seems, of course. Andy is happy, but he must find Agent Cooper.
And Lucy is left disappointed. And, you know, I feel like it's kind of poetic justice in a way, because she's been stringing these guys along the whole time, you know?
Well, that's what she gets for playing the expectations game.
Yeah. She was expecting to have like this big, like, oh my God, I want to be the dad. How could you have picked him? Blah, blah, blah. It's Dick Tremaine. He's going to be like, you just gave me a free ticket. I'm out. Yeah. So she got her just desserts on that one.
Yeah. So Annie is crowned queen and the lights suddenly go out. The place is illuminated with a strobe light, I guess. There are explosions, screams. I guess the strobe light would probably come from the emergency lights or something. Is that a standard fixture?
That's a good question. I don't know. The only time I've ever been like in workplaces and stuff like that, when there's been power outages, you generally get one light,
red,
or two lights that illuminate right by an exit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're almost like searchlights. They're just really powerful, and that's all you see. I've never been anywhere where like strobe lights have gone off and then smoke bombs. So I think this is a construction of Wyndham Earl.
Wyndham Earl, yeah, definitely is responsible for the explosions. There's people screaming, people running in fright. Nadine gets knocked out by a sandbag. Wyndham Earl gets his clutches onto Annie and chloroforms her, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I assume it would be.
And Andy finally is able to tell Cooper that the petroglyph is a map.
Finally, at the end of the goddamn episode, he's able to get through. How much, we already talked about it, but how much time and effort could have been saved? Poor Andy.
So any final thoughts before we move on to feedback?
No, I think we covered most of it. Okay, our first piece of feedback is from Joel. What's up, Joel? Stephen M. Amazing to think that this episode aired back to back with the finale as a 2-hour movie back in 1991. Aside from the story continuity, it's hard to think of two more different episodes of the show. By this point, ABC had officially canceled Twin Peaks, and columnists everywhere were ridiculing the series as one of the most disappointing ever. This episode did horribly in the ratings, losing out to reruns of Northern Exposure. Ooh. But I'd still imagine a few people tuned in who hadn't watched the series for months, maybe since Laura's killer was revealed, or even earlier. They must have been so surprised to be greeted by a cheesy Miss Twin Peaks contest, a supervillain dressed up as the Log Lady, and a bunch of nonsense about Jupiter and Saturn. Hopefully they stuck around for the last hour. Anyway, I'm usually not too hard on late season 2, but I think this is the worst episode since Josie's death. It feels so tired to me, like all the participants are just going through the motions, ready for the show to be over. It does kind of have that feel, mm-hmm. like the last day of school feel.
Yeah.
You know, where everybody's present, but they're not really present, you know, physically, but not mentally. They're already checked out. Short-timer syndrome.
I especially felt that with the scene between Ben and Audrey.
Really?
Yeah, I felt like I was getting the impression that they were just thought their lines were stupid. But they're maybe because I was thinking that. I could have been projecting.
It could be because their lines were kind of stupid.
They were.
So what can they really do with them? Indeed, director Tim Hunter says that when he appeared on set for the first time since Leland's death, he was stunned by the dip in morale. Apparently, Kyle MacLachlan was the most cynical about the turn the show had taken. Ironic, given that he contributed to this turn when refusing to do a romance with Audrey. Well, enough negativity. Let me focus on some highlights. But before we do, I just want to say it is ironic that Kyle MacLachlan could, you know, turn down what they really wanted to do with the story. And it's been pointed out before that that was going to be the main thrust of season 2. And then he said no to that. So they had to take all of the B story plot lines and bring them up. But as interesting as that would have been to see, I don't know if it still would have saved season 2 from a certain level of mediocrity.
Yeah. I don't know if they would have done the pageant and everything, though.
Probably not. We probably would have been saved from that particular bit of ridiculousness. I love Wyndham Earle's black teeth look in the beginning. Definitely his scariest moment ever and one of the highlights of the show's back half. According to Tim Hunter, he got the idea from the Japanese films he had been watching. It's a very kabuki look. I wonder if this influenced the makeup Laura and Leland wear briefly when they are possessed in Fire Walk With Me. Then again, Lynch used this type of makeup in early short films, including The Alphabet and The Grandmother, so maybe it's just a coincidence. Another bit of fun, easy to miss, is Donna and Shelley goofing off in the background in the chorus line, giggling, purposely dancing out of step, and sharing a cigarette. There aren't enough moments on the show when the teenagers just get to act like teenagers, so I thought this was great. It also might just be Laura Flynn Boyle and Mation Amick refusing to take this beauty contest nonsense seriously, and if so, that almost makes me like it even more. Yeah, agreed. We touched on it earlier. But
I think that's what it is.
Yeah. Either way, it's good because, I mean, the teenagers getting to act like teenagers is good, but I choose to think that it's the latter. So I also enjoyed this episode's callbacks, even though I'm not sure how conscious they were. Notice that Miss Twin Peaks dancers are dancing in plastic raincoats, wrapped in plastic like Laura. That probably was intentional. When Wyndham Earle appears in drag as the Log Lady, the real Log Lady disappears from the screen. They even make a big deal out of Pinkle expecting to find her there and tripping over himself. This feels like the show calling itself out for replacing the funny but moody mysticism of the first half, represented by the Log Lady, with the Batman parody villain of the second half, represented by Wyndham's disguise. But I doubt the writers were thinking that much about their storytelling flaws at this time.
No.
Who knows? Yeah, that would require them to be a lot more self-aware than we probably would, you know, give them credit for, considering what's being offered. And of course, we get the most explicit reference to Laura's murder and its impact on the town that we've had since her mystery ended. It's appropriate that Annie, the oblivious out-of-towner, is the one to casually name-drop Laura, and I love Shelley's response. I think we're going to need more than a day. That does sound like an explicit acknowledgement of how quickly and ridiculously the character seemed to move on after the big revelation. I love how Lynch will take a hammer to Twin Peaks' short memory in the coming episode, bringing back so many characters, images, and themes that had been forgotten, to the point where they weren't even written into the script. I'm looking forward to that. And with the news of Lynch directing all 18 episodes for the new series, it's safe to say that this will be the the last lynchless Twin Peaks we will have to sit through. Farewell, Miss Twin Peaks. You will not, pardon the pun, be missed. No, that pun is perfectly acceptable. No pardons needed. See you next time for what is, in my opinion, the best episode of the show. Hope it doesn't hurt this much in a week. Joel.
Thanks, Joel.
I love a good pun. Don't have to apologize for those.
Yes, Steve loves puns. It's his favorite kind of joke. All right, next up is Daniel. Hey, Steve and Em. I always feel like this episode is a letdown after all the buildup of the previous one. Cooper and Harry's rapid-fire exposition feels really forced, like the writers have run out of time, and so the characters have to suddenly figure everything out in this episode. Then, while Miss Twin Peaks does have some enjoyable moments, we already know Annie is going to win, not because it makes any logical sense, but because she has to win so she can be kidnapped by Wyndham and Cooper can chase after her into the lodge. Thus, it has no dramatic tension whatsoever, and much of the pageant, such as Lana's dance, feels like a chore to sit through. And fucking Andy can't find Cooper in the one-room roadhouse. Good point. For me, this is the episode where I feel that Wyndham Earl has true menace to his performance. I really like that shot of him with an ashen face and his mouth blackened. Tim Hunter said he did that effect as an homage to Japanese Ozu Mizoguchi films he watched. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. In Fire Walk With Me, when Laura visits Harold, she gets that same white face and black lips. I think her teeth were yellow, though, weren't they? A yellowish green?
Yeah, I seem to remember that.
And after killing her, Leland trudges to Glastonbury Grove, and there is a shot where his face looks like that as well. Do you have a theory on why that happens to people? Well, we've already discussed that, so.
It's kind of a half-baked theory that we came up with just on this podcast, but it's not even really a theory. It's more like trying to fit the pieces together and come up with a justification for why it was done. So, I don't know. It could have been something that was done visually by Tim Hunter because he was influenced by these movies, and then Lynch really liked it and put it in Fire Walk With Me. So then it has to have some in-world importance, and we talked about that being, you know, the proximity to the lodge. But then we kind of had to shoot that down because Cooper didn't have it. But it could be your intentions, too, because hate and love are the keys that get you in. So if you go in with love, maybe you don't have to worry about that. But if you go in with some sort of negative, malice-influenced emotion, maybe that's the manifestation. Who knows?
Maybe it's like the telltale bubo of the Black Plague. Once you have it, you know your fate is secured. And if you once you turn ashen and you've got the black lips, you're heading to the lodge, man.
There's no lancing that boil. You're done.
Yeah.
It's the telltale sign.
Yes. I know the pageant probably wasn't conceived by the writers until now, but do you think Laura was crowned Miss Twin Peaks in previous years? There's nothing written about it in The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. It's kind of eerie how all the girls open the show with a dance chorus and clear plastic raincoats, and whichever girl wins has been marked for death. It's too bizarre a costuming choice not to have been a deliberate attempt to evoke the first image of dead Laura wrapped in plastic. Yeah, I mean, it's in a way making a mockery of it.
I kind of feel that way, too. I didn't think about it until Joel brought it up, and now Daniel's bringing it up. And once again, these guys are on the same page a lot of times. So it is kind of like a mockery. It really is, because it's less of a callback than it is a mockery, now that I really think about it.
Because, you know, with Annie, like Daniel says, we all know Annie has to be the one that's taken. So it's already a given that that's going to happen.
Right.
And they're making all this comedy beforehand.
Yeah.
This Laura's situation was handled with a lot of seriousness. And I feel like we've covered this ground before.
But it keeps coming up. So we have to keep covering it because it's like a damage to the show in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because to me, the humorous current that runs through Twin Peaks has always been a little bit to the side of the normal story that's going forward. But when they put it out in the forefront and say, this is the main thrust of what we're doing.
It's really ham-fisted.
Exactly. That's a great way to describe it. It's ham-fisted, and it makes light of something that's very serious and dire and was the genesis for the whole show in the first place.
It's pretty sad that Ben is apparently so divorced from any sense of human ethics that he needs to read through a bunch of religious texts just to figure out how to be a good person. Laughably, though, I don't think his piece of ageless wisdom, that time heals all wounds, is actually from any of those books, so he's just bullshitting Audrey there.
Ah, so it's not from those books. I figured they were, because I haven't read any of them either.
Well,
so
he said he culled it.
Yeah.
From those books, so.
It just sounds like a, you know, he ate it. the Twin Peaks Chinese takeout place, and it was in the fortune cookie, so he just figured that it had to be some sort of Eastern wisdom or something like that. I don't know. His character isn't going to get any better. He's not going to be a better person for reading religious text. He's going to be missing that fundamental like morality that you don't get from just opening a book about religion and reading. In a nutshell, what I'm trying to say is that there's a mistake out there in the world of philosophy that people think that religion and morality are the same thing, and that if you have one, you have the other, and that's not true. That's actually patently false, because one actually predated the other. We had morality first,
Well, do you think
because
it's
it.
possible for him to obtain?
I don't know. I mean, like they say, it's hard for a tiger to change its stripes, hard for a leopard to change its spots. The whole thing. It's possible for him to do it, but it seems like he's aware of what morality is and what the right ethical choices are to make, but it's just so difficult for him to not be Ben Horn and make the bad choice.
So Daniel goes on to say, like when Mike revealed that Bob feeds on fear and the pleasures, Wenham Earl's rant about how these night creatures that hover on the edge of our nightmares are drawn to us when we radiate fear echoes Frost's use of vampire myth. This concept finds its ultimate expression, though, in the film's use of the creamed corn, Garmonbozia. Just the idea that there are terrifying entities out there who are alien to our comprehension, but feed off our misery and negative emotions like pain and sorrow, and seek to cause as much of it as they can, truly pushes Twin Peaks into the realm of a horror story of cosmic proportions.
That's a really good point.
A really good way to put it, too.
That's a creepy concept though, because when you think of dealing with those types of negative emotions, fear and pain and sorrow and stuff like that, you think of the other people that you're relating them to have a complete contextualized understanding of what you're going through. How they react to you having those is up to them. But to have these entities that don't really understand what they are, but know that they want it. It's like it's like this alien baby shoving food in its mouth because it tastes good and it has this insatiable appetite for it.
Yeah, when you say horror on cosmic proportions, it makes me think of H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
But I can't really relate that to Twin Peaks, though.
You
Can
can't really
you?
relate it to Twin Peaks, but if you're looking at these entities and you're seeing them as an alien force, not aliens as in spaceships necessarily, but alien to our experience as human
Right.
beings on the planet, and it is in a more cosmic sense, because you bring in the whole Project Blue Book and the rest, it fits in a way. I mean, it could be seen to be just as Lovecraftian as True Detective was. all True Detective, I'm not knocking the show, but all True Detective did was drop the King in Yellow and Carcosa, and that's it. That's all we got that was Lovecraftian, period. Trust me. And but it's this idea of cosmic indifference. H.P. Lovecraft hit on this idea of cosmic indifference to our fears and our sorrows and our sufferings, even our hopes, dreams, and aspirations, and that we were this tiny, tiny little speck of dust in a literally infinite universe, and we were dwarfed by beings that we couldn't understand. So there's a little smidgen of that going on here with Garmonbozia, because it's the pain and sorrow that feeds these creatures, but they don't understand what it means to us to have to experience that pain and sorrow, and that's fucking scary.
Like a whale feeds on plankton.
Yeah. The whale has no conception of what the plankton's going through. It just eats it up.
And of course, because the writers wasted so much screen time, it feels like we have to literally rush to get Annie and Cooper in bed together as quickly as possible before she gets kidnapped. They stretch that forest metaphor way too long.
We didn't really talk about it in the cast proper, but it was a bad metaphor to begin with, and it really did get stretched too far. I didn't talk about it then, but I mean, I didn't like it. I thought it was cheesy. But I was critical of the whole scene, but I didn't. That was one thing that I didn't bring up. But it was just heaping negativity on top of negativity. So
When she says, I feel like I see half of my life on your face, what does that even mean?
I took that to mean that when he looks at her, there's a certain feeling, like she feels like there's maybe like a sort of condescending pity, or like, oh, I know you've been through so much, and I want to like coddle you and take care of you and keep you snug and safe away from this bad world that did all these things to you. And she doesn't want to see that. She wants to get out there and be open and receptive to the world. She's afraid of it, but she wants to do that on a certain level.
So she sees that on his face and then wants to go ahead and start kissing and have sex.
Yeah, that's a mixed message for sure. But if I'm correct, or at least even partially correct about that assumption, it does make it kind of contradictory move for her to jump into bed with him. But maybe she's proving to him, saying, look, you're seeing all the negative, the negativity of me that had to hide away from the world and that produced these scars that I have on my wrist, but I'm shedding that and I'm jumping into the world as it is. I came out of the convent and into your bed. And so that's my trajectory here.
I love how Hawk finds Major Briggs without even trying. He naturally possesses all the intuition that Cooper thinks he does. Sorry, though, if my calling attention to his badassery every week sounds like a broken record. I just love his awesomeness, and I wish he got acknowledged for it more often by other characters in the show. I agree with you, Daniel. It's actually quite funny now. It's almost like
It's a running joke we
it's a
have.
hidden joke that nobody intended, I think.
You're right. Nobody intended to do that. It's not like the show's even really aware of it.
I
I
don't
think
think they
they
are.
just use him as like they have Harry doing and fulfilling a certain role, and then they have Hawk actually doing all the police work. And I've always looked at it as, and I'm sure I've said this three or four times on other podcasts in the past, but I've always looked at it as if anybody is really trying to tell us anything like that, it's some subtle commentary about how the bosses don't really do the work. They have the people underneath them do the work and then just take the credit for it.
I like to think that the whole plot about Eckhart's puzzle box is a self-aware commentary on the show itself. Mysteries inside mysteries, whose cavalier reveal turns out to be a massive explosion.
That's a good way to look at it. I never thought of it like that.
I forgot to bring it up when we were actually covering it. It's just like, why are they assuming that there's something good inside?
Yeah, why would you make that assumption? I mean, this box comes from Eckhart, the arch nemesis.
Well, I mean, just because Catherine assumes that it could be a great fortune. Why would she think that?
Yeah, there's no reason at all. I mean, Jones gave her the box that contained the box that has the key. So, yeah, just the assumption that something or anything good would come out of that box is a little bit wrong-headed to begin with.
I never liked how a planetary alignment is the mechanism and allows access to the lodges. It feels too literal and physical for a spiritual place that always seemed like it had more to do with dreams and states of mind. It's funny that they say that they have to be at the door at exactly the right place and time or it won't open, and then go on to say that the time is between January and June. This episode and the finale originally aired in June, so I think that that was their little way of trying to make it feel current.
That's funny. There's a lot of coincidences going on here because we're covering the last couple of episodes in the middle of June right now,
Yep.
and so that's kind of some synchronicity for whatever it's worth. But yeah, it doesn't fit though because they're covering their asses in a way by saying between January and June, and Laura died in late February,
Yes.
early. So really, we can't even be out of the month of March yet if you go by the chronology of days versus episodes.
So based on this, can we guess that the 2016, 25 years later, is going to be between January and June when the season airs?
God, I hope not.
I know that would be tough for us as podcasters, but
That's
I'm
gonna
thinking
overlap Vikings and Penny Dreadful. We are not gonna be able to breathe for 4 months.
it'll be worth it.
Yeah, we'll do it. Don't worry, we're professionals. We'll knock it out. But I mean, that's gonna be some like marathon, no sleep kind of shit. But I was more kind of hoping that it would start in September, maybe run to like January kind of thing.
That's what I'm hoping too.
But
Maybe they've announced it. I haven't looked it up. Who knows? We'll find out.
I'm kind of calling bullshit on that. Like, how do you just go, oh, well, sometime in January to June? Well, that's half of the year, literally. So how do you figure out, how do you pinpoint a time within half a year? They don't really say how
I
they
don't
got to.
fully understand what's being said, so I really can't contribute to this
I don't
discussion too
think we're
much.
supposed to be able to fully understand what's being said because that way they can't be like kind of held to a standard. Like, well, you said it was this time, so
Yeah.
explain it.
I need more information.
I think they just hope that, yeah, you do need more information. And I'm thinking they hope the viewer just kind of tunes out at a certain point and says, well, this is just astrological stuff. I'm not going to understand anyway. So.
Daniel goes on to say, if the big secret between Horns and Haywards is just that Ben is Donna's biological father, then why don't her parents just tell her that? She's a grown woman, and the fact that they continue keeping it secret just makes it seem like the truth is something even worse. With everything Donna has uncovered so far, it seems like the most obvious thing in the world, yet the writers went out of their way to script it so that no one, not even Ben Horn, when Donna asks him directly, actually says that Ben is her father. He starts to say, your mother and I. This makes me think they originally had some kind of twist planned for the next season. Do you agree that it's just too obvious? Yes. Especially since the birth certificate said Eileen Hayward as
Yeah.
a maiden name.
But that's just has to be a mistake. I mean, what else could it be? So, I mean, the only other thing we can think of is that Doc Hayward is the grandfather, Eileen's his daughter, who he's pretending to be married to, and then Ben is the father of Doc. That just makes no sense, but
I think there is going to be more of a twist, or there would have been more of a twist.
I
Yes.
would have liked to have seen them pull it off, but this is what we get stuck with, and it's not that big of a reveal, especially since you, as the viewer, understood it several episodes ago
Yeah.
that that's exactly what was going on, and now you're just like waiting and waiting and waiting for somebody to just drop the other shoe and say, yes, that's what's going on.
It makes no sense to me that if the police knew whichever girl won the pageant was going to be targeted for an attack by Windham Earl, that they wouldn't just cancel the event.
Good point. Why let it go on, especially if you know that you don't have the police force capacity to stop Windham Earl doing whatever devious plan he has in store, which they did not.
They needed the bait.
So now they
So
know.
now we can discuss their ethics
Yeah.
and their morality.
I'd just rather discuss their bad police work.
There are some really weird, awkward background moments in this episode, like the random extra carrying a deer mannequin across the screen who looks like he's grinding his crotch against it for some reason, or the completely mortifying way Mr. Pinkle appears in the to be molesting the log lady. Yeah, we've already discussed both of those. I mean, I said he was trying to cuddle with her, but what's his deal? Is it because when Lana's dancing and he just, I mean,
That was
if
like
there
the
was a post, it would have been a post he was like cuddling up against, or, but Log Lady was there, so he's cuddling up against her.
I think it they just wanted to interject some of that Twin Peaks weirdness into it to have a weird, kooky character like him be attracted to her, who she's not attractive by any, I'm not trying to be uncharitable towards her, but she's not the kind of person that you're just going to roll up to in a bar and be like, "Hey, let me buy
The
you a
Log
drink."
Lady?
Yeah, the log lady. She's not traditionally or conventionally attractive. And there's another lady that's sitting like one chair over from her who kind of has like a Betty Page haircut,
Yeah.
who is attractive. So, but he's not over there trying to get with her. So
I don't know.
I don't know. I think they're just trying to push that weirdness angle. Like, look, this guy thinks that Margaret's attractive and he's trying to get with her.
Windham Earl dressed as the log lady is the one disguise I actually approve of. I mean, it reaches a whole new level of self-aware parody, but I can't help but love it.
Yeah, it's definitely self-aware parody. Definitely.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like saying, we've taken it this far, why not take it just a little bit further? Let's just have some fun with it. And it is probably his best costume. I do like his professor costume when he's having Audrey read the poem because it seems to fit the way that he talks. Like you could see him being like a junior college professor somewhere teaching literature. But he actually kind of looks like Margaret. That's why this one was a good one though.
I didn't think he looked like Margaret.
I mean, the hair and the glasses and the log. I mean, if you didn't know it was happening for the first couple of seconds you saw her, you might be fooled. All he needed was the pitch gum.
Pay attention to the fact that Wyndham cracks Bobby in the head with that log, and we don't see Mike suffer any kind of injury to his head in the chaos that ensues. Yet in the next episode, we see Bobby looks completely fine, yet Mike's whole head is bandaged up. Could there have been any weird significance to the fact that Mike gets the injury that Bobby should have? Is it somehow a reference to Mike and Bob? In the original European pilot, when Mike shoots Bob, he inexplicably collapses and dies as well. I always wondered about this seeming continuity error. So, do you think, based on the end of the pilot, that it somehow explains Mike receiving more of the injury that Bobby should have been displaying?
That's a really interesting theory. I mean, it could be because how else do you explain it? He gets hit in the freaking head with a wooden log. That's gonna leave a mark.
I think it's charitable of Daniel to decide that's what it is, or to hope that's what it is.
But it's keeping in the spirit of what we've been trying to do this whole time, is to try to find, instead of just going, that was stupid or that was just a plot device, we try to find that like reason why this could be or why this did happen. Is to be somewhat charitable, give it a little leeway. It's all about the benefit of the doubt. You know, like this could be what they're trying to do, and that's preferable than to just going, you just wrote a shitty piece of story right there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so kudos to Daniel for giving us information that compares it to the European pilot. So when we do come across this, what could be a continuity error in the next episode, we at least have a possible explanation for it.
Yeah, it puts forth a plausible scenario with which everything can maintain a level of continuity. Which is always good.
Anyway, so moving on. Dick Tremaine is off the hook and a free man once again. I fear for that baby living past infancy if Lucy ever leaves Andy alone to watch it, though.
Just the fact that he's telling her he's going to be a good father, and it sounds like he's struggling with the words that are coming out of his mouth, should scare you. Intention is one thing, execution is another. You have to be capable of being a good father. Your intention to do so is not enough for a child.
I think he'll do fine.
I believe he will, too, because Andy's got a good heart, but he's prone to accidents, and, I mean, is he going to start crying the first time he has to change a diaper? You know, like when he sees a dead body? It's... Who knows?
I couldn't agree with the mayor more. Annie's only been in this show for 5 episodes. I think if there had been a season 3, Lana would have killed the mayor next with one of her sex heart attacks as punishment, just like his brother Dougie.
Well, at least it would have been to a good end to an annoying subplot.
I just wish Lana would have won and she would have been the one taken to the lodge. It would have been way more interesting.
It would have been interesting because then you'd have to have Mayor Milford follow her into the lodge and have those scenes with Wyndham Earl.
Well, Cooper would have still followed into the lodge, but I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't have been interesting at all. It just, nobody would have cared about her, but we didn't really care about Annie either.
But Cooper did. Yeah, Cooper.
And that's what matters because he has to sacrifice himself so he can become possessed. And
that's why they had the whole scene where they get laid, is so it can be believable that he would do that.
Yes.
And it would not have been believable if he chased Lana, so.
I can't believe we are already to the finale next week. It has been so much fun writing into you all these weeks and dissecting each episode together. See you in the trees, Daniel.
Agreed.
I know.
This has been a long, fun journey, and it's coming to an end, and we're kind of sad about it, but...
It's definitely been a marker in our lives.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll ever forget this.
No, I mean, this has been...
We're going to be on our deathbeds, like, remember when we broadcasted on Twin Peaks?
Shut up, woman. Give me my pills. But, yeah, it's been a fun trip. I'm kind of sad that it's over, but we still have a little while to go because we've got the next episode to do, and then we've got... Of course, we're going to do Firewalk with Me and then The Missing Pieces. And then we're going to do a bonus podcast after that and then a feedback podcast. I don't know if those are going to be one and the same. But that's at least another month of podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. We'll have more coming out.
We might
take a 2-week break for Firewalk with Me just to give myself the time.
Yeah.
So I am planning on that.
Okay. That's good. Yeah, that's good to know in advance. That way we can, you know. All right. Next piece of feedback. Oh, by George, I think you've got it. From John. He says, hi, Stephen M. I'm really glad your friend Paul didn't have time for this podcast because your decision to be spoiler-filled is the big draw that none of the other current Twin Peaks podcasts have. It makes me so happy to know you call this cast your Hermione because it directly mirrors how I feel about this podcast versus all of the other podcasts I listen to. It's got that same magic synthesis of style and substance that makes for the best episodes of Twin Peaks, which means you're also reflective of the show you're covering. This show works on so many levels, and I'm pretty confident this cast will live on fondly with the fan community for years to come. Well, thank you very much.
I think people like Daniel and Joel and yourself and Tyler, if you guys were to do a podcast, it would be a lot more thorough.
That'd be something I would want to listen to for sure. So I'm glad that you guys want to listen to this, and I'm glad that you feel that it sounds that way and it brings that kind of thing to the table. And, hopefully it does live on with the Twin Peaks community for a while.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't mind being a, you know, like, hey, if you're ever listening for a Twin Peaks podcast, you know, this one's good and that one's good, but make sure you check out Sparkwood and 21 as well because they, you know, that's a fun time. I would be completely satisfied with that, you know. Yes, thank you for the kind words. And at the end of the day, I just hope that, you know, this podcast and the other work that we put out can live up to the high praise. That's what I hope for.
Yeah, and I mean, at any rate, it's been fun. It's been a great journey for us, and it sounds like it has been for you. So I'm glad we've gotten to communicate with people we would never met otherwise and have these great discussions and open our eyes towards viewing Twin Peaks in a way that I would have never viewed Twin Peaks if it wasn't for this journey.
Yeah, it definitely changed it for me, too. Sometimes not always for the best, if I'm being perfectly honest, especially some of the parts of Season 2 that aren't so hot that we've, you know, discussed at length by this point in time since we're very, very close to the end. But the parts that are good have been made, they've been reinforced, and they've been made even better. And that I appreciate that. So I mean, you know, because we're doing this to kind of hopefully enhance the listeners' enjoyment of the show, but it's also enhanced our own enjoyment of the show. So it's like a double whammy.
And it was a great way for us to prepare for Twin Peaks 2016.
Yeah, for sure.
Because we would have rewatched it anyway, so.
But I mean, a rewatch just for, you know, your own entertainment's sake and to kind of refresh your memory is one thing, but then to rewatch and do get down to the nitty-gritty and dissect everything
Yeah.
is another thing totally. So it could be a double-edged sword because it's probably upping the ante on our expectations for 2016. But I mean, David Lynch and 18 episodes, even if only half of them are really good, that's still 9 episodes of great David Lynch directed Twin Peaks, and that does not sound bad on any day of the week. John goes on to say, and I know this isn't a parenting podcast, but I've got a quick note to your listener, Leanne. Not to say your maternity leave won't leave you enough time to rewatch Twin Peaks, but I know how it went for my wife with our boys. Having twins was kind of like going to war. The boys did not always sleep at the same time, so we couldn't even sleep when they slept, except maybe for an hour at a time. Jesus Christ. And this was essentially 4 straight months. I'm hoping you're having a single baby so you have a fighting chance of being able to do things like watching Twin Peaks again. Otherwise, take a deep, deep breath and know it gets easier. Either way, congrats and good luck. My boys own my heart, and that's the best thing in the world. Cool. From one listener to another.
That's cool
Awesome.
that you guys are communicating like that.
Sounds like good advice. It makes me glad that I don't have an infant child in the house.
I know. We've decided not to have kids, and you're reminding us that it was okay that we didn't.
Yeah. Because we probably definitely wouldn't be doing the podcast. If we
No.
wouldn't even have time to rewatch the show, we definitely wouldn't have time to do this.
But don't let me forget to, I will right now congratulate Leanne on her pregnancy and congratulate yourself, John, on your twins.
Cool.
I'm glad they own your heart.
He says, back to the show. I've seen every episode at least 12 times, and I never once noticed Eileen Hayward was listed under maiden name. I always assumed Donna was born after Eileen married Will in a she and Ben had an affair sort of way. But having this new idea that maybe Will was somehow Eileen's dad or similar relative helping raise his grandkids as his own kids, this is a mind bender. I'll say there's no way that that would be the real answer, but after Leland's being the killer and Ben and Audrey having that near miss in One-Eyed Jacks, I wouldn't put anything past the writers. Thanks for giving me something else to think over. This goes back to something that we talked about early on in the scenes to where whenever this stuff was written back in the early 90s, we didn't have DVD technology. People weren't rewinding stuff. They were just watching it at home when it came on, and then they'd talk about it the next day at the water cooler, and then you go from there. So attention to certain details wasn't always par for the course. But now they're tied to that. They have to make something of it because it's
Yeah.
there and people know about it.
Yeah.
So whether it was intentional or a mistake is a moot point. It's now canon, and they have to go from there. I think the more remarkable thing is that John has seen every episode at least 12 times. That's a lot. That's some dedication. As much as I like the show, I don't know how many times I've seen the first season episodes, but I know for some of these second season episodes, this is the second time I've watched them in, you know, the whole time that I've known about Twin Peaks. So whereas maybe the first 7 or 8 episodes I've seen maybe, I don't know, 6 or 8 times. This last one that we just watched, this is definitely only the second time that I've seen it. And with this episode, there's a lot of good and a lot of medium level stuff. The "Your forest is beautiful" conversation makes me upset like normal, except I can look at it like Annie knows she's a wooden character, and Cooper knows she's a wooden character, but he loves her anyway. Bark and all, 2x4s, 4x8s, let's not talk about any more trees. It reminds me of that scene with Pete and the missing pieces, I think it is, where he's like, no, it's not in the missing pieces, it's early on in
Right, he's
the
like
four
2x4s,
by eights.
four
He's
by eight.
like
It's like it's
marking
a
them off.
pilot.
Yeah, he's marking them off on his
Yeah.
little book. Ian Buchanan, per usual, shines as Dick Tremaine, bringing his soap opera background to nice effect. That scene in the storage room makes me laugh every time. The more I watch him, the more I think he completely understands his role in this series and lives within the show, much like Wendy Roby does as Nadine, and
Yeah.
even Harry Goes as Andy when he's working with the better directors who know Andy isn't developmentally challenged. I have agreement on all points that you just brought up there. I think Ian Buchanan and Wendy Roby really do know their spots in this show, and they work it. And I think Harry Goes does too. And it works especially well when people aren't treating him like he's mentally challenged, because I never really thought of that before. But I think sometimes during episodes that are directed by other people, it does kind of feel that way. Like he's being treated like he's special, and he's not. He's just, that's just Andy. That's just part of his personality. He goes on to say, "And that makes me wish like hell Catherine was used in any serious capacity for the past few episodes.
Yeah.
She's a scene chewer in the best possible way, but being relegated to babysitter of old man children makes me constantly forget her during this part of the series. Piper Laurie deserves better." I agree. I never thought of it as her being a babysitter to these two old men, but I guess they really couldn't make a good scene with just the two of them. So they have to have her there, and they have to have something to do with her. But they got the key out of it, so everything's great now,
Yeah.
right? Sure. Overall, I'd say Tim Hunter did a good job with this episode, considering he got saddled with needing to include the actual Miss Twin Peaks event. The girls wrapped in their plastic coats for a few weeks after Laura was found is in terrible bad taste from the Twin Peaks planning committee, but it was a nice touch for us viewers. And the strobe light scenes were handled in about as Lynch a way as possible, reminding me of how well he handled Leland's death scene under the fire sprinklers in the police station. And Kyle MacLachlan does a great job feeling one step behind Earl. I never talk about MacLachlan, but his understanding of that character is impressive. Even though it really screwed up the path of the show, I can honestly believe why he could make a case that Cooper would never have had a relationship with Audrey, because he understands both the way Lynch writes Cooper and the way Frost does as well, and he dances between those sensibilities as well as stares down the llamas. I don't care if Cooper is possessed by Bob or is himself again in the 2016 episodes. MacLachlan's there, and he'll make it magic all over again.
Yeah, I agree.
That's a good way to look at it.
I wonder how often that happens anyway. We only hear about it when there's things kind of go south, but how often does that happen is what I'm asking. We just don't hear about it. And, you
Yeah,
know,
he's kind of like
because
the.
other writers have been successful, you know, navigating that conundrum where, you know, here they didn't succeed, and so Kyle gets saddled with the blame.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think that has happened before, and the writers have just, like,
Rolled with the punches and
roll
dealt
with the
with it.
punches and did their job that they get paid for, and they made the show work. They said, okay, we cannot go this route for whatever reason, so we're just going to make this work. And they do, and you as the viewer see it as seamless, and you would never know that it was intended to be another way at another time. But because we know so much about the world of Twin Peaks, because it's been like broken open and, dissected and bisected and vivisected, it's this knowledge that sticks out. And I think the main issue here is that there's a lot of shippers, and what we term them now. We didn't call them then back then, but there's a lot of people who wanted to see him and Audrey get together, and they're peeved about the fact that that didn't happen. So they kind of hold a little bit of a like passive aggressive grudge for Kyle MacLachlan. So they say, well, he has to bear some of the responsibility for season two being less than season one, because he didn't want to play ball, and he decided to go something different. With all of the material at their hands, at their disposal, all of these different storylines that could have been, they could have come up with something better than what they did. And just to say, well, we weren't able to have this one love affair, how much screen time would that have really taken up?
I'm just not sure if it would have been better. I mean,
Yeah.
or that much better, I guess is what I should say, because again, they're still going away from the things that really attracted to us, which was the oddity, the fear, the cosmic horror that Daniel describes, like, 'cause they still left Philip Gerard behind, they left Sarah Palmer behind, all these things that were swimming around in that ether of weirdness, it's gone. And I mean, how would have Cooper and Audrey's relationship navigated us into that world again?
And how would they have, how would that have had any kind of impact to where they wouldn't have left Sarah Palmer behind? The fact that Cooper and Audrey would have had a love scene at some point, they still would have had to drop Audrey. They still would, or I mean, Sarah, they still would have left Philip Gerard's storyline dangling and never to be returned to. And
Yeah.
so it's just like, it's blaming him. It's disproportionate. It's blaming him for something that wouldn't have really made a difference in the first place. I don't think it's fair.
And just like other people have brought up, like, why not? It might have been John himself. Like, why not have Donna's storyline be about the fact that she saw the Tremonds? Like, keep it in that same vein. But they didn't. I, you know, I understand people wanted Audrey and Cooper. I don't know if it's because you really wanted them because you thought they had really good chemistry or because of the storyline they went with in season two, how you feel like it would have been better with Audrey in Annie's place. I agree with that. I do agree it would have had more impact. I can see how things would have felt differently if Audrey was there instead in Annie's place. But overall, does it still make the story just as good as season one?
No, it doesn't. That's not going to be the saving grace that everybody thinks it was going to be.
Yeah.
And that's really the root of this. Everybody thinks that it's like a magic bullet solution to stuff. People think that it's going to be this one thing in place could have saved everything, and it wouldn't have. This week's episode was another solid one, and it's the best ma and its best magic trick is overcoming Forced on Us Annie and Miss Twin Peaks, one and the same, as well as it could. After the commercial break, bring on the lynch. Take care, John.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for writing, John.
And John, I read your email about the books, and I think there's only like one or two of them I don't have, and I'm gonna go ahead and purchase them. And I will write you back about that as well. So, oh, and I did not mention the song that we have for our intro. It's called "Psycho Swing," and that's from Pond 5.
Somebody was asking about it.
It was him.
Oh,
Yeah, I forgot.
okay.
I said I would mention it, and I forgot last episode. So,
Yeah, Pond 5 is an awesome site.
all right. Next up, Tyler. Hey guys, I can't believe we're on the penultimate episode of Twin Peaks. I'm excited, but I'll just jump right in. The log lady intro today starts out about logs themselves. Margaret talks about what the circles and the crosscut of a log means, and about how long it takes to grow a tree. She continues on to say that there are some things she's comfortable talking about and others she isn't. For example, why her fireplace is boarded up and why there will never be a fire there again, though she is comfortable explaining exactly what her log's purpose is as a reminder. I assume they chose to talk about fire again since we're returning to the Black Lodge soon. Maybe like comfortable things being equivalent to the White Lodge and things she's not comfortable talking about being equivalent to the Black Lodge. I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe she's focusing on the log so much because Windham Earl dresses up like her and hits somebody with one. Now, there's probably a deeper meaning to it, but I'm not sure. I mean, she has to get a little bit deep and philosophical about, what the nature of the log is this far into the season, or this close to the end, rather, I should say.
If you get too desperate for bonus material, you could always cover the Log Lady intros. Haha, I do think you should at least watch them all. They have some nice tidbits, though they're not all winners. But to be honest, I'd be really happy if you did the diary before any other bonus material. I think it's the most tied to the Twin Peaks universe. Okay, we'll do that first.
Yeah, that is the one that is tied. Well, I've only read like one and a half. I've read parts of The Diary of Laura Palmer, and I've read Dale Cooper's My Life, My Tapes.
Yeah, I think we'll do the diary first, and then we'll do that one, then we'll do various other books after that, so.
Because there's a part in the Cooper tapes where he recounts he actually hits a woman. So he normally doesn't advocate that type of behavior, but in this scenario, in this situation, it was called for and necessary. And so I'm thinking, wow, there's how much else in here do I not remember that's probably completely out of character for him, or at least the character that we know who kind of came into Twin Peaks.
In the recap, the shot of Bob's hand reaching out over the oil has the mayor's voice over it saying, "This isn't right. There's something wrong here." Needless to say, my first laugh out loud moment was before the opening credits.
So that made you laugh out loud, the fact that it was the mayor overdubbing the voice, that's a weird juxtaposition.
Yeah, so I need to check out this previously on to see if I can get that same laugh.
It would be kind of funny though,
Yeah.
just to see something as evil and wicked as Bob doing anything, and then to have Mayor
Mayor
Milford,
Milford.
even if he is saying something kind of cryptic, but
Even though he's saying it about the microphone. But
yeah.
I like the little scene in the diner, even if its main purpose may have been to name drop Laura Palmer and remind the audience of the pageant. I'm not surprised Norma won back in her day.
Oh, I'm not surprised either. I mean, it's like they said she could win today if she went in it, but I mean she's one of the judges. But like we mentioned earlier, when we were doing some other feedback, that it took that scene to just kind of it shocks you back in. You're like, oh yeah, there's a reason why everybody's here. There's a reason why all this is happening, and it's Laura Palmer. It's not just her picture at the beginning of the end credits anymore. We can kind of bring her back into focus a little bit.
The bank subplot at the end of the Audrey scene is incredibly thrown together. I do not think the actors do the best with a weirdly written scene.
I don't think they do either. I think that they have to understand. I mean, any actor is probably going to agree with that, you know?
Like I said, I felt like they were kind of phoning it in with that, and the morale that Tim Hunter was talking about, that one of our other listeners already mentioned, I think I was detecting that there.
Yeah, well, it's just I'm a cook by trade, and if I get some really killer ingredients and some really good cuts of meat or something like that, and I got a good recipe to work with, it's going to be good food and you're going to enjoy eating it. If you give me hot dogs and some buns, you know, and some mustard, you're going to get hot dogs and buns with mustard on it. I'm not a magician, you know. Damn it, Jim, I'm not a magician. It's what these people have to work with. That's their trade, and if they get a bad or just overall shitty script, it's not going to be the best performance from them. It's going to seem stiff, and that doesn't excuse Annie's stiffness. I mean, I think that's just that's a combination of a couple of different things, but it's going to feel off.
Tyler says Harry is drinking coffee here and is able to focus on the mystery instead of his emotions. He actually does a decent job connecting dots here, but then again, Andy doesn't have any coffee and he figures out that it's a map. I don't know. I still think Harry has Jameson's in his coffee cup because he's all like, Queen of Romania?
He like Harry was a useless appendage in this episode. Not that he hasn't been before or to some varying degrees in other episodes, but he was completely useless in this episode. He didn't contribute anything good. He didn't, I mean,
He was a sounding post for Cooper.
yeah, that's about it. When he told him about Josie, that was, I mean, he had like what, he spoke maybe 20 words in the whole thing.
Next is the last we see of Leo. Tarantulas precariously overhead in some makeshift cage. Did Earl make this cage? He must be crafty since he made the pond before and now this. Yeah, if he can make that pond, I'm pretty sure he can make that cage.
He's a crafty, dafty sort of fellow. You know, it just occurred to me that after he leaves, really Leo could just kind of like slowly let the cage down
And roll over.
and just kind of roll over to the side. The spiders are going to be trapped in the cage. The only way they're getting out is if he lets it go from that height and it falls down and breaks.
Yeah.
So if he just slowly lets it
Slows the
go,
velocity down.
of course, we're expecting Leo to make this cognitive jump, and that's maybe not fair to his current state of mind.
Well, he's was able to get a key and figure out how to use that, so I think he could do it.
Well, I guess we'll find out.
When Lana said they were on break, she just walked off from practice. I noticed that. It would have been funny if she got disqualified for this when she got back from the prop closet or got caught in the act. Yeah, that would have been funny. They should have just did that.
Well, they never had intentions of her winning anyway, but they had this weird little subplot where she was doing everything and anything in her power to win it,
She
you
had to
know.
distract Andy from getting to Cooper right away. Didn't he stop, pause to watch her?
Yeah.
Did he?
Yeah, he
Am I
did.
remembering that
Because he comes
correctly?
in, he's like, Agent Cooper. And then he just kind of stops in mid-sentence and just stares at her because we've
Yeah.
already established this weird storyline about how she has this hypnotic effect on men.
Cooper says he's finished meditating for the second time instead of sleeping. Does that mean he hasn't slept in days? Does he not sleep again from this point on?
I'm not sure. But I have read some stuff about meditation, and they say that while it's not really a medically recommended substitute for sleep, people who do meditate and they get like seriously into it and they actually reach that transcendental state, I guess, that you're looking for, they don't require as much sleep to function normally as regular people do.
David Lynch meditates twice a day as a rule.
So he probably need, I mean, if they're recommending 8 hours of sleep per day, 7 to 8 for a person, then he could probably get away with like 5 or 6 for a period of time and not really suffer any ill effects because of it.
And I think he does 2 20-minute sessions of meditation a day in the morning and in the evening. And he's been doing that for decades.
Man, that's got to do you good.
And that's how he that's what he credits his creative process. His ability is to meditation. Okay, so if you know to whether Cooper sleeps or not at this point, I don't know. Are you asking this because you're wondering if that somehow plays into the events that happened in the last episode and maybe it could be an explanation for some of the things that are going on? His lack of sleep.
Maybe if he had had a good night's sleep instead of meditating, he would have been a little bit sharper and realized that he needed to cut Windham Earl off at the pass rather than fall into his trap. You know, instead of showing up at the Miss Twin Peaks pageant, or like, you know, it's already been discussed in this podcast that we could have just shut the whole thing down in the first place if we knew that there was danger, if we knew somebody was going to be kidnapped. But
I'm wondering if they're wanting to let us know that he's in meditating, because that's how he's coming, he's getting these epiphanies, like the Jupiter and Saturn conjunction.
Could be. Or he could be meditating in ahead of and in preparation for his trip to the lodge.
Yeah, maybe it's a way of purifying.
Yeah.
Who knows? I wonder what haloperidol smells like, since Cooper can tell that's what Briggs has been dosed with by sniffing him. I did a little reading about the drug, but couldn't find anything online about its scent, so I guess I remain curious. Yeah, I did the same thing, Tyler, and I couldn't find anything about its smell.
I think this is, you could probably chalk this one up to, it's just an easy way to let the audience know that he's on haloperidol instead of having to take blood and then wait for that, you know, it's going to take a couple of days to filter through the actual medical testing facilities and stuff like that. So they're kind of giving us this fake idea that it has a smell that you can detect. But it would have been interesting if you guys did research and it came up and says, well, it smells like seared onions.
It would have been nice if they had laid that groundwork with Philip Gerard, if he had learned to smell it, even though Philip Gerard was on a special mixture that contained haloperidol, but it wasn't just haloperidol. Anyway, I'm sure you've discussed the actual pageant at length, so I won't say too much. My favorite moment is when the log lady shoves a choreographer off the stool. I also enjoyed Audrey's speech, though Annie's was also pretty good. I thought Audrey delivered it better, but I don't know. But I didn't find either of them to be really moving, honestly.
No, I didn't find either of them to be really moving. And it was lamentable that through all of that ruckus and silliness that we didn't get to see Audrey or Annie or Donna or Shelley's special talent.
I know.
You know, I would have liked them. I would have, more than seeing Lucy or Lana do a dance, I would have liked to see any of the three or four of them do that.
Yeah.
You know, why couldn't we have seen that?
So I know.
It's kind of a wasted opportunity there, but.
He says, I love the whole last part of this episode with that strobe reminding us that evil is afoot. Overall, great episode. I thought it was funny, had a good build and a good ending. Can't wait for us to get to the finale, Into the Night, Tyler. Thanks, Tyler.
Yeah, thanks for writing.
The strobe light does have good effect, but I feel like it's been used a lot in various shows and movies in that way. So the events that I could see taking place while the strobe light was going on lessen the effect, like Nadine getting knocked out, Wyndham Earl's stupid little bomb remote, and Cooper being, you know, deterred by, you know, this tiny little explosion in front of him.
It could have been handled better.
It just seemed really cheesy to me. The strobe light was probably the best part of it, and I don't know, if that's the best part, not much going for it.
It almost would have been better if the strobe light didn't happen at all, and then, you know, Andy's flashlight could have come on and just kind of been sporadically, you know, going around the room. And
he's just yelling, Cooper! Cooper! Trying to hunt him down, and we're seeing all the chaos within the light.
Yeah, like you just see little snippets of whatever he sees with the flashlight beam rather than the strobe light. Because the strobe light, it's been done so many times before, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen movies where there's like, I'm almost thinking like Blade or something like that. They're
so
in
I guess
a club
you could say
and...
Sense, because this came out before Blade. And
yeah, that's true. That's true. But I want to say that I know there's something that predates that. There might be a similar scene in the first Terminator, but I don't think it's really a strobe light. It's just flashing lights.
It wouldn't be Hellraiser, would it?
No, I don't know. I can't remember specifically. But I know whether it's before or since, it's kind of desensitized you at any rate to that kind of thing. So it could have been original at the time and not too much more coming before it, but it just feels like it could have been done better at any rate. I don't think it was a shitty scene. I just think that there's the little miniature explosion wasn't really sold on that.
So that's it.
Yeah, a listener of ours, Mike Gorham, he listens to Twin Peaks as well as Penny Dreadful, right?
And I think Vikings too.
And Vikings as
I
well.
I think.
But he had sent us a link to a YouTube video of the band Lamb of God, and it said, check this out. You might not like the music, but there's something familiar in the episode. And sure enough, I don't remember the name of the song, but you get halfway through the video, and there's a chick in a river, dead, wrapped in plastic.
I'll retweet it because he tweeted at us. I'll retweet the
Yeah, so
video.
everybody can check out the video. We just watched it, so I don't, it's my fault for not remembering the name of the video, but he said that we probably wouldn't like the music, but I actually like Lamb of God. So I don't know, I'm a metalhead.
You're not a huge fan of Lamb of God, but
No,
you.
I'm not a huge fan of Lamb of God. I don't actually own any of their records, but I hear a lot of them on SiriusXM Liquid Metal when I'm driving to and from work. And I'm a fan of the band that they used to be called Burn the Priest. And I've got a couple of their older records, and they had some split 7 inches with a couple of bands. But I actually dig their music when I hear it. I actually had their one of their songs as a ringtone. My friend Chuck put it on there for a while when I had that little crappy flip phone. And
Yeah.
every time it would ring, it would be, I don't know the name of the song, but if I heard it in a second, it would just bring back all those memories of that time. But it's a pretty cool video, and it's a direct homage to Twin Peaks. I mean, you have somebody wrapped in plastic, and it's a dead girl. I mean, I don't think they really made her look like Laura Palmer, but it's definitely there.
We didn't finish watching the video, so there could have been more to it that was more closely related to Twin Peaks.
Yeah, we didn't we got to that point, and we figured we had seen, whatever it was he intended us for us intended for us to see. If you're wondering about other metal related stuff to Twin Peaks, there's one I know off the top of my head. If anybody's a fan of the band Anthrax, on their Sound of White Noise album, their first with the singer John Bush, who used to be with Armored Saint, they have a song called Black Lodge, and Scott Ian, the guitarist, is a huge, huge David Lynch fan. And so this is about the Black Lodge, and it is about Twin Peaks in general, and there's a video. Now, if you watch the video and you watch the lyrics, they kind of steered away from being too direct about letting you know, but it's there. It's
Don't they have another song that samples from Blue Velvet too?
Anthrax, yeah, Anthrax, they did a remix of their, I don't know how many people are familiar with this, but way back in the 80s, Anthrax did the song I'm the Man, and it was really the first rap metal song that ever came out. And they did a remix of it in 1991 on their Attack of the Killer Bees record. And it has a sample of Dennis Hopper from Blue Velvet saying a couple of choice words to Kyle MacLachlan's character. So it's worth checking out. Just YouTube it and
Which
listen to it.
samples?
It's the one where he says, "It's I can hear you fucking radio, you stupid shit."
That's
And
right.
then it also has that's from Blue Velvet, and then the other part from Blue Velvet where they're drinking the beer, the whole Heineken thing, and it says, "Fuck that shit." And he's like, "What are you drinking, Heineken? Fuck that
But they
shit."
sample it or they loop it, don't they?
They sample it so it sounds like he's singing it.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I heard it.
It's worth listening to.
Thanks, everybody. So, all right, we've got one more episode of Twin Peaks, and then we'll take a 2 week break after that before we do Fire Walk With Me. All right, well, that's it. We will talk to you next week. Have a good week. I am your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.